productive day, and I appreciate everyone here because you've been a big part of making this, I think, a productive day, actually. Your presence makes a difference. I'd like to point out, for the record, we're going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 5077. Unfortunately, there were several people that were unable to stay till 6 o'clock. Nell O'Malley from the Corvallis School Board has given us some written testimony that's very, very good. Dramatically points out the 33% reductions in Corvallis District. We've got something from Janine Stice, Kendall Area PTA president from Salem, reiterating some of the terrible cuts that have happened and what's happened to her own children. She gave us some information for the record. Virginia Farkas from Eugene is full of frustration, like all of us, about the standards we're asking for and yet not supporting it with the conviction of the money behind our rhetoric. And then a nice missive from Chris Ullman, a physician that, again, is asking us to step up to the plate and match our words with a little bit of action. So I appreciate that. That's sort of been the tenor of the discussion we've had and the call for adequate resources. And I really appreciate everyone's indulgence. I'd like to call up Anna Gonzalez and Jerry King from Tigard, if they're still available. And then Mike Fox, and Doug from Forest Grove. I'm not sure I've got that. Come right up, please. If I've called your name, please step right up to the dais. They may come in later, or they maybe have to go. I apologize. It's so hard. A lot of things going on, believe it or not. Appreciate you guys waiting very much. I appreciate your indulgence. Okay, why don't we get started? Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Mike Fox. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of Eugene School District 4J. Chairman Schrader and honorable members of the committee, I have two messages today. First, our schools have taken enough cuts already. The children of Oregon need and deserve good public schools and a well-rounded education. It is within our ability to provide it. Second, $5.05 billion for a K-12 state school fund budget is not nearly adequate. We need at least $5.3 billion to educate our children this biennium. Ideally, we should fund the quality education model. At a minimum, we must have reasonable class sizes and offer a comprehensive educational program. In the 2002-2003 school year that just ended in June, the Eugene School District cut 78 positions, including 55 full-time teachers. Class sizes increased by an average of 2 students, and class sections at middle and high schools were cut. I'm going to give you some examples of these cuts. South Eugene High School cut 17 class sections, including core classes, math, English, and social studies, as well as foreign language, art, health, and theater last year. Over the last 10 years, the high school has cut 20 teachers, yet has about the same number of students. Those 20 teachers taught 100 full-year classes that are no longer offered. Class sizes have swelled. We now have classes of 40 to 50 students and fewer opportunities for students to explore their interests. I've been to a number of them. I can tell you we have kids that are now sitting on window ledges in classrooms that are overheated, stuffy, sweaty, and smelly. It's just really not a learning environment. At Monroe Middle School, the average class size was 33 students last school year. That school cut 11 classes, including math, language arts, and science. Twin Oaks Elementary School had 27 to 30 elementary students per classroom last year. Our district has tried to preserve smaller class sizes at the elementary level during those early learning years, but that's no longer possible. These are just examples of the impact of inadequate school funding on 3 of our 35 schools. Each school has made similar cuts. Before the passage of Measure 5, the Eugene School District offered a truly excellent educational program. Over the last decade, which encompasses nearly all of my tenure on the board, we have cut regular classroom teachers by 20%, cut librarians by 55%, cut PE teachers by 32%, cut central administration and support staff by over 32%. We have closed three elementary schools. We have reduced or eliminated hundreds of elective programs and classes ranging from advanced placement classes to vocational programs. And while our special education enrollment has jumped by 52%, we've increased special education staffing by only 20%. And like Salem-Keizer did this year, 1 year during my term, just to keep things from falling apart completely, and in the, I guess, vain hope that perhaps the Legislative Assembly would take notice, our entire staff from the superintendent on down had a pay freeze. Now, the Eugene community itself is making extraordinary local contributions to our schools. We have a local school district, local option levy that funds the equivalent of 54 positions, 54 teachers. Eugene, alarmed at the class sizes and cuts that our district made last year, the city itself passed a levy that would fund school athletics and 45 full-time positions, including elementary music and PE teachers, media specialists, counselors, and school nurses. The city levy was meant to help the district restore teachers, to restore classes, and to restore programs that have been cut, not to offset further cuts or to let the legislature off the hook. In fact, one of the greatest concerns we heard in opposition to the levy prior to its being passed was that it would provide an incentive for the legislature to duck its responsibility in adequate funding of public schools. The cuts that we have made have touched all students, but the impact is far greater on lower-income students and students whose families cannot afford tutoring or counseling services or even adequate medical care. For these students especially, less funding for public schools means less chance for success. That is not a promising future for these children, nor is it a promising future for our state. This isn't part of my remarks that have been delivered to the committee, but I can tell you that 4J is one district that is absolutely committed to closing the achievement gap. We have received a substantial Wallace Reader's Digest Fund grant, and we're working hard to do that. We are disaggregating the data among all of our students so that we can track the performance of each and every student so that none falls behind. And I can also assure the committee that the 4J board is perhaps one of the most fiscally responsible boards in the state. We have managed to get through the last several years by prudently managing our reserves. We have a target unappropriated ending fund balance every year of 5%. We occasionally are dipping into it. The only way we're going to get through the next biennium is to dip into it a little bit. Actually, it's more than a little bit. But our board policy is to restore our unappropriated ending fund balance to the 5% level within 2 years. There's a lesson in here someplace that I would like perhaps you to take to the rest of your colleagues in the management of state budget. And lastly, I want to tell you that before Measure 5, Eugene 4J delivered a program to all of its students that was the rough equivalent of the quality education model that we're all now starting to talk about. So when we want to get back to the quality education model, That means that we're trying to get back to a program that existed when I first started my tenure on the board in 1992. It's shameful that we have fallen this far in the last decade and 2 years. I think it's time that we took this matter seriously, and as the chair stated, it's time to put our money where our mouth is. 4J is committed to providing each and every one of its students with the best possible education, but it can't do it without commitment from the state. 4J has led, as a matter of fact, the State Department of Education in the language and the goals for setting the certificates of initial mastery and the certificates of advanced mastery. We're proud to say that the State Department of Education looks to us for how to do things. We're proud to help the state, but we need help, and all of our schools need help in order to get to where we ought to be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fox. Good testimony. Proceed.
Chairman Schrader and members of the committee, my name is Russ Dondero. I live in Forest Grove, have for 34 years. I teach political science at Pacific University, but my views, as I state in my extended comments in the written draft, are my own. They do not represent Pacific University. However, they do represent a person who's been a parent of two children who are now young men in their 20s and 30s who graduated from Forest Grove High School and the public schools in that district number 15. I'm also a product of Roseburg Public Schools in an age long ago, in the 1950s. And I, as is my wife, a product of the public schools and a former public school teacher, and now a librarian, who's feeling the effect in her own job of having to fill in the gaps caused by District 15 in Forest Groves, basically eliminating the library program. So that's all the burden of that shift over to the public sector city library and the understaffed group of people that she is part of. So we are living with the legacy, as my predecessor just eloquently said, of Measure 5. And that really is obvious to us all. I don't need to preach that to this choir. You know that. And I'm not going to go through the 5 pages of testimony. You can read that on at your leisure. What I'd like to do is respond to some of the comments that have been made thus far and to sort of put them in my perspective, or if you will, give my spin to them. Number one, I perceive, and I lay it out in greater detail, that we're facing a budget straitjacket. And I commend Senator Schrader for his leadership from the beginning of this session on this issue. You have stepped up with the committee now to, you know, hopefully get us in a position where we can and you can negotiate with the House. And until that point comes in this session, late as it is in the day for the session, the fact is the process has really begun. A former lobbyist who's no longer with us taught me in 1991, and I was down in this body as a housing advocate, which I've continued to be as a citizen on a sabbatical leave, that the leadership gets what the leadership wants. And I think that's where the rubber hits the road, and you all know that. And leadership are you, as well as the governor and the House leadership and the Senate leadership and the key members of the former Joint Ways and Means Committee, as well as the budget committees, which you are now constituting. In that context, if you do the simple math, and I'm only good at simple math, if you see the continuum of 4.8, the original co-chair budget, to the quality education model of 6.5, and you average those two out, you come to a budget figure as a target of $5.7 billion. If I were in your shoes, rather than go for the governor's 5.3, which I'm very critical of, but I understand the politics behind that, I would go for a 5.7, simply because it's closer to the target of the quality education model but I think it's also reasonable given the economic realities in front of us. You may say, well, how can that be reasonable? We're stressed out with no money. I would like to suggest that there are options, and I will enumerate those as I did in my testimony. Secondly, I want to echo what Susan Castillo, the superintendent of public instruction, said earlier in the day. The question really before Oregonians, not just you, but the governor, you, and Oregonians, is whether we're going to settle for second best or even worse. I was down in this building in 1991, as I said, and I watched several things happen in the wake of Measure 5's passage. I watched Governor Barbara Roberts say at her inaugural address, and be roundly criticized in the media for it, that some people will die because of Measure 5's passage. I don't think we have to debate that anymore. Kip Kinkle was the most obvious example in his victims. But we have countless stories in the Oregonian of a young man who was suffering from bipolar disorder, who lost his medication because he couldn't get it because the Oregon health care plan no longer covered him. And countless other stories of people who either literally die, commit suicide, or are in harm's way. So the question, I think, becomes not just in education, but beyond that, is Oregon willing to settle for second best? But in 1991, we passed what's called the CATS plan, the Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century. And I was here in this body watching it be passed. Of course, it was passed without any discussion about the potential $1 billion price tag that was then bandied about in the press. But one of the things in the Oregon Education Act was a goal of school attendance days, or what we call teacher contact days. We're now in a state where we are seeing, ratcheted from the 290 school districts, school days lost and contact time lost of anywhere from 5 to 17 days. In 1996, according to the Oregon Educational Act, the goal was to have reached 185 school year of total days of coverage, of teaching. By 2000, it was 200 days. And this is compared to Japan and Germany and other competitors who have either year-long schools or a minimum of 220 days of class time for their students. So my question rhetorically, thinking back to 1991, where are we now in terms of those goals of the Oregon Educational Act of the 21st century, let alone all the other things, portfolios, et cetera, that I think to a large degree are on the cutting room floor because of the economics of Measure 5. So the question is, can we settle for second best? I argue we cannot for all kinds of reasons, and you've heard many of them. I won't redo the testimony of former Speaker Lundquist. He was very eloquent about the economic circumstances, and he deserves credit for being one of the main people behind the educational quality model. Thirdly, the impact upon lower-income students, which the gentleman to my left just mentioned, was something I put down in my own notes. There are students from my school district in Forest Grove, which is not a wealthy school district. It's a working-class school district. It may be a suburb of the Portland area and part of Metro, but in fact, it's a relatively modest income area. And in that particular district, I don't think we would have the option of local support for the schools the way Beaverton, Eugene, and Portland got it. It's not viable. We don't have the economy to support it, and we can't get the kind of support necessary from the local people. I've run two election campaigns for a budget. One failed, and one won. And it's not easy. And that was in the good old days before Measure 5. I'm also concerned about what this means for lower-income kids and minority kids. 20% of Forest Grove kids speak Spanish as their primary language. 20%, and that's increasing every year. The diversity of students across Oregon, whether it's Forest Grove, Beaverton, Portland, Redmond, Roseburg, you name it, is changing. The disability issue is changing and challenging us. So whether the demographics are racial or are income demographics or disability demographics, it's more costly to educate a young man or young woman in today's climate and prepare them to be, quote-unquote, part of a world-class workforce or set them ready to go to college. As a college professor who sits on an admissions committee, has done for 4 years in most recent reiteration, done so earlier in my career, I'm concerned about the asterisk that will be put on every senior student who graduates from this state from now on, whether they go to a public or private university here or somewhere else in the state, which will say, well, they graduated, but they graduated from a substandard teaching environment where they didn't have 180 days or even 170 days. What is the remediation that's going to be necessary at the college level for those students who didn't get the full year of effort that they deserve in their 4 years or their 12 years? What's the cumulative impact going to be on that in terms of higher education here in Oregon and on them as young men and young women? So I think what you do, as was said by my good friend Jim Sager, the issue before us is what do we want to do versus what you can do. And I would argue that what we can do is really a function of what we want to do, and I would suggest we shoot higher than the 5.3. Because to do less than 5.7 is to really, I think, not stand up to the potential that we have. Now, let me give you some suggestions, and I won't go into detail.
We'll probably want to move along.
I'll wrap it up. I'll wrap it up. I think you are not without options. In fact, Senator Schrader and others in this body early on have talked about options, both short-term and long-term. Sales taxes, beer and wine taxes, real estate taxes, tax credit deductions, fees. When Governor Atiyo was governor in the early 1980s, with a similar situation, in fact, the unemployment rate in that year was 12%, not 8%. He and the legislature, without referral to the people, went for a 10% income tax surcharge for 3 years. And they did it. And Bill Sizemore and Don McIntyre, they may have said boo, but that's all they did. I think part of it is we need to not bend to the perceived power of the people who are initiative petitioners who might want to oppose something creative out of this legislative body. I want tax reform, and I want it now. The governor of Alabama and the governor of New Mexico have been earmarked by the Oregonian in articles in the Oregonian about governors who are willing to step up now and risk their political capital because the crisis is now. It's not 2 years from now. It's now. You've heard that. And you've been hearing it all session from these people in front of us. So I would suggest that, you know, politics is the art of timing, and politics is also the art of leadership. There have been some great leaders in this body. I've been down here since 1975, bringing students. I had 65 students here last week, and we talked to a variety of folks in this building, legislators as well as lobbyists, concerned citizens. And they're all education students who are going to be in 15 months teachers looking for a job. The question I have for them and for you is, will they be looking for a job here or in California or Nevada or New Mexico? I have a deep affection for this body. I have respect for each of you. I have respect for our governor and for the leadership in the House. This is not easy doing any of this. But, you know, there is something about the Oregon spirit that we must keep alive. And I think in that context, you know, the pride in place and the sense that Oregon is a place that's different, that we do things differently. When you go back to the bottle bill and land use planning, et cetera, we've had the Tom McCalls and the Jason Bowes and the Vic Atiyas and others stand up and be counted. Frankly, this is your chance, and I hope you do it and take that ball and run with it down the field because we need your leadership, and I thank you for allowing this forum to exist.
Thank you very much. Good testimony.
Good job.
Yes, Senator Carter, question?
Please? Yeah, please, thank you. Mr. Fox, I'm really going to keep my question limited. But do you, and I know Dr. Dondero's position, but Mr. Fox, do you believe that the quality education model, along with No Child Left Behind philosophy, can be accomplished at the 5.3 level?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. I mean, it's nowhere near going to be accomplished at the 5.3 level, and we're kidding ourselves if you think you can do it. I mean, what you have to do, essentially, is to add back all of the folks that I testified in my testimony that we've cut, and add back all of the programs that 4J has cut, and that's going to get you up to roughly the point something or other billion dollar figure. So you can't get to the quality education model without warm bodies other than students in the classroom. You can only have it by inspired teachers trying to inspire their charges on a variety of subjects that we can no longer teach them because we don't have enough people in the classroom. And that's the only way you're going to do it. So 5.3 is woefully inadequate. I agree with my colleague here that at a very minimum we ought to go halfway in between and go for 5.7, but we need $6 billion and then some. And I don't see any money trees around here, so but that's my answer.
Yeah. Can I respond very quickly? Senator Gordley made a very telling question to my good friend Jim Sager earlier in the day. What is this a step toward? And I think that is the question. What is this a step toward? And I thought of the metaphor of MASH. We are in a MASH unit in the middle of a war where tax reform, I think, is necessary now, not 2 years from now. Because if we don't do it now, it's like having a soldier on the battlefield in Iraq in a tourniquet, in a MASH unit, and you've only stopped the bleeding temporarily. It's going to come out somewhere else. He needs or she needs to get to a hospital to be repaired and be made whole. So 5.3 is better than 5.45 and 4.8. But it still means, as someone said, you're stopping the bleeding. That's all you're doing. We got to do more than that.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both of you for being present and for your testimony. And Mr. Dondero, your words are just so so eloquent, and I'm struck by how you titled your presentation, Where Are the Profiles in Courage?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm not finished.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
I have this habit of pausing every now and then.
I apologize, Senator.
I'd like to take you to page 2 of your testimony and the last paragraph on that page.
Okay.
Because it echoes a message that some of us have been trying to drive home since this legislative session began. Mm-hmm. And I would like if you would please give voice to those words mm-hmm. for the record.
Are we talking about the reference to the budget?
To the Oregon Constitution.
Yeah, right. I was stunned. I asked some questions early in the session. Where is this budget requirement that we have to have a balanced budget comes from? And, you know, I've taught political science for 34 years, and most of it in this state, and a lot of it in this building. And so I didn't know. So I asked a wise colleague of mine as a lawyer, I said, show me the language. So he showed me the language. And what I find interesting is that the constitutional requirement, according to Article 6, Section 7, and Article 9, Section 2, and I reread them last night, require the legislature to raise revenue. And it requires the legislature to raise revenue by levying taxes. And it does for the current year and the ensuing year. If I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to pretend to be the Attorney General of the State of Oregon or your legal counsel, but the way a simple political science professor from Forest Grove reads it is that we have an obligation to step up, not just to cut, but to actually look for options, revenue enhancement options, taxes, new taxes, or increasing taxes. That's our constitutional obligation, as I understand it. I know that's not easy, but that's what the Constitution seems to require of you.
I thank you, and I thank you for bringing the words forward, and particularly at this moment.
Thank you.
I will share with you that less than an hour ago, I was in a gathering with some of my colleagues, and we were talking and struggling around this point of tax reform, tax mm-hmm. restructuring, now or later. And I have to admit, I was starting to feel somewhat tired and a bit worn down and not like giving up, because mm-hmm. it's not in my nature
right.
to do that, but just a little tired and worn down.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank you for bringing the words back in the form that you have and within the frame that you have, because it inspires me to keep pressing on and to stand with my colleague over here to fight the good fight. Thank you.
Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Senator Winters.
Just a quick question, because there's a lot of discussion, and most of the discussion centers around the amount of dollars. Whether you're talking 5.3 or whether you're talking 5.6 or 5.7 or 5.05. And I guess I have a fundamental question. Some of us grapple with the issue, and No Child Left Behind is mentioned a lot, as well as the QEM model, the Quality Ed model, and I was a part of the Quality Ed model review last session. My question is very basic, and that is, what assurance, if you do allocate the dollars, that children still will not be left behind, that individuals, particularly in the disadvantaged communities and the ethnic communities, when I look at, for example, dollars that have been allocated through the Department of Ed for specific purposes, and those dollars do not get to where those students are, how do we address that fundamental issue of making sure that children, no child, you know, when I say no child, I mean, you know, no child is really left behind, that dollars alone won't solve that problem. And I guess I'm asking you, because I think you've done a lot of research and you've really have delved into this, and thank you for mentioning my former boss, by the way, Vic Attia.
Okay. Well, he's a great man. He and I are personal friends, and we and I go a long way back. I guess my answer is Senator Winters, you look the person in the eye and you say, I'm going to hold you accountable. And that person is Susan Castillo. And I know Susan Castillo. My younger 24-year-old son worked for her in her campaign. One of the four staff people. Ran a lean, mean machine. I also knew her predecessor, and I respected him, even though he got himself in a difficult situation. The fact is, I think you can only hold people accountable in this very personal sense, as well as the political sense that was referred to earlier. But I trust Susan Castillo, given her lived experience, and I think it makes a big difference. Someone who is obviously sensitive to what it means to be a minority, or what it means to be low income, which is not to say someone like me, who's been middle income and all his life, can't understand. My father was the director for the Housing Authority of Douglas County for 25 years. I know what low-income people are like and what their concerns are.
I'm very concerned about this. Yeah. Well, I grew up in Portland, I grew up in the school system, there weren't any differences in how we taught.
Right.
Because we were in really a small minority, so you couldn't do things differently. Your educational curriculums, you know, taught across the board everyone. Mm-hmm. Now, when I look at what's going on in my metropolitan Portland area, in the school that I attended, which was Jefferson and those community schools, I feel very saddened.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very saddened that we even have the discussion. Mm-hmm. I have to have the discussion about No Child Left Behind.
Yeah. I'm sad,
and
too.
So, you know, it's one area that I'm, whether we're talking about Portland or we're talking about...
Let me quickly interject that when you read the full text, you'll see that I'm very critical of what's become of the Oregon Reform Act. If I were voting, I'd vote against it tonight, okay? Not because it's not a good idea. It was a great idea, but it's become teaching to the test. And there's no way you can prove to me on anybody evidence, and I've taught in the MAT program for 12 years. I think I know something about the subject. And I know something about the way it operates in Texas and Massachusetts. And we took the lead. But sadly, we veered from the course. So I think your question is very important.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. I think we have to move on, to be very frank with you. We've almost spent 25 minutes, and we really need to let other people have traveled here to spend time with us, an opportunity to talk. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Let's, if Ken Hunsicker, Jim Robinson, and Rich Goward are still here, appreciate their infinite patience. I'm sorry. Come on up. Senator Ford, yeah, just for a moment.
Gotcha.
Please continue. I've got to step just real quick. I'll be right back.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Robinson. I am the superintendent of schools in Lebanon. This is my 20th year as a superintendent. I was in Reedsport before that. And I want to share a couple of things almost by way of preface or context for the rest of my remarks. And I, in the name of brevity, I'm not going to go into how our district has lost positions and so on. You've heard plenty of that this evening, this afternoon and this evening. But I want to establish a couple things that I think are really important from a management perspective within the districts. And first among those is to give you an anecdotal story of our district, and then a little bit about myself, just very briefly. On June 29, 1999, Lebanon Community Schools had $15,000 in reserve on a $25 million budget. They were about done. Over the period of the next few years to get to the year just past, 02-03, we sold property, closed some buildings, did what we had to, ran at about 85% speed because we weren't using all the money we had to try to accumulate enough cash position that we could create a financial shock absorber for what we have just experienced. Last year's budget had $2.4 million in reserve, which is about a 10% factor. Now, we heard Eugene talk about a 5. That's okay based on size differences. They're many times larger and a lesser percentage would serve them. For our size, we have to get to a larger percentage to measure out. So we entered this year with $2.4 million. I'll go into the – I am now entering a year, 03-04, with $230,000 of that left. Because we decided to hold her steady and trust that somewhere in the 5 special sessions and this regular session, we would be rescued. So we didn't lose days, and we haven't yet lost class size, but now we're going to. Our day has now come because we've spent out. A little about me personally, I'm the son of an 8th grade educated logger who taught me two things that I've never forgotten. One is the value of a dollar, and the other is the value of an education. He taught me that a dollar only spends once, and we've just spent $2.1 million in my district to hold her steady. Now, when we talk about restoring things, I look at my shock absorber, which I've lost, and no, I can't spend it again. We're running on the rims, and my shock absorber's gone, and we're talking about inflating one tire or two. It's not going to work. Now, out of that fiscal conservatism that I was taught, I've taken that attitude to our bargaining table, and we've just completed a round of bargaining with our teachers. And I'm sympathetic to the fact that they shouldn't carry this burden. I'm frankly astounded at the level of personal sacrifice and contribution they make, anteing from their own pockets and spending extra time doing chores and duties that were never theirs. And I observe that in my own district, and you've had plenty of that testimony today. Our bargaining required that we get language that would afford us the opportunity to remove prep time from the student contact day. Because when you teach a 4-period block in a high school with 60 teachers, fully 1/4 of those in any given period are doing preparation. And so you're teaching with 45 teachers. If you take that time out of the day and put it on the shoulders of the day, they can teach all day long and you can teach the same load with 45 staff members and let 15 go. That was an issue at our table. We should never have had to have that conversation. It's not the right way to do preparation time. We held raises to 0.5% for the year gone by because we were already a year out of the contract, and 0.75% for the coming year. We capped insurance at $620, and we sunset a very lucrative benefit supplemental benefit retirement package in 3-year periods so that only less than 1/4 of the teachers currently on staff will enjoy the benefit that many of them had anticipated for 20 and 25 years. That's the kind of work we felt we had to do at the table in negotiation. And when when I'm caught in a management position where I'm inadequately funded, I am then required to make those kinds of hurtful conversations occur at the bargaining table. And frankly, we have suffered more than we would certainly have liked in terms of the esprit and morale in my district because of it. And now that we held her steady and spent the money, now we make the cuts, and where is our morale going to go from here? There's a misperception I'd also like to correct about PERS. There are a couple of points. One is that for all the fixing we could do about PERS, I'm not sure yet that we've closed the other door, which is the district's ability or inability to hold the line sometimes around benefit issues like that. You close it here, we'll hear about it at the local table. But more than that, folks are talking about the benefit of not having to have budgeted 18%, and we can budget 11%. In reality, we budgeted 12.73 last year, and we're budgeting 11.11 this year. The net savings in my district is a little over 1%, only $200,000. There's no windfall from 18 to 11. That was an interim projection that we never used. That's selling a dream that there's money there somewhere. There's none. PERS isn't going to fix that. We did, to get those gains, have to talk to our association about reopeners. And we've done that, and we've agreed to reopen on a 4% swing up or down from March's projection. So if we get 4% more money, I'm sure that they're going to ask to come to the table. And if we get 4% less money, if the economy for some reason even worsens more, we will ask to go back to the table and make further adjustments. That is an expedited process that is completed within 90 days, and you do bargain hard in good faith because it does have tremendous impacts for how that goes. But in the end, in an interim bargaining, it resolves much more quickly and probably more carefully for the school district because implementation is at hand in those situations. Now, of course, the employees, if it were significant enough, can take an employment action or a labor action against anything that we might unilaterally implement. But that unilateral implementation is right there at 90 days. And so I don't find that to be quite as threatening perhaps as some other folks might. I did want to highlight those things. I do feel are important. They are a management perspective on all the loss and how we have to govern at the local level when we're underfunded. So I do thank you for that opportunity. I do hope that sheds a little different perspective from some of what we've heard this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions or comments?
I just have, because I don't think you meant to trivialize the $200,000 savings by your district, because if I calculated 198 districts time, the $200,000, it becomes substantial, and I didn't think that you meant to trivialize that figure.
Not at all, Senator. The measure, though, is against what it would have been had we really had a year at 18% and then came off of that. We didn't come off of 18%. We came off of 12.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Your testimony is compelling. To use your words, hold her steady. 5.3, do that?
No. At 5.3, I would have to cut in the coming year 60 positions. I can get back about 16 of those. You'd have to get over. Holding her steady to me means also restoring what I spent. If you want to put me back where I was, I need the money I spent. And then I need to avoid all the cuts I'd have to make to balance. So we're out a year on that. We'd have to get up around 5.9 to hold her steady.
Follow up?
Certainly.
Are you suggesting you restore your reserves all in 1 year, 2 years, or by your reference?
Obviously, it would be unreasonable to expect that we could do it in a year. But that's what we'd have to get back to be held perfectly harmless. Obviously, it took us four to build that amount, and that comes at some sacrifice because you're not operating at full speed. Asking my staff to do that now a second half decade is going to be terribly burdensome. We had been very clear, because of the issues that that can create at the table, to say, trust us, when we get to 10% of our general fund budget, we will then operate on 100% of all that we receive from then on, and that money will rest in reserve. Now, they are thankful that we had it there because they haven't incurred some of the loss that some other teachers around the state have in terms of lost days or frozen wages and those kinds of things. They're about to because it's spent so quickly. They do now see the advantage of having that available and building it back. How we get back to that, Senator, is a very difficult question, and it will obviously take more years than one. It's unfortunate that it's spent out in one.
Thank you.
Again, thank you very much for your testimony. Good evening.
Good evening.
If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kent Hunsaker. I come to you maybe in a couple of capacities. Currently, I am Ozzie Rose's replacement at the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. The only good thing about the session going on longer is that I get to keep Ozzie with me a little bit longer so I can learn from him in the next while. I'm also a long-term educator in the state of Oregon. For the past 24 years, I've been a superintendent. The last 16 years, I was the superintendent of the Bethel School District. I come from a family of educators. My father was a long-term superintendent in the state. And I love education. I love children. A couple of things. The first thing I wanted to say was appreciate this committee and your listening skills. I'm amazed. I'm truly amazed with how good attention that you pay with all the things that are out here. And I'm glad that I was here today with you all day. I heard sad stories, but compelling stories about what is happening to education in this state. As I think about that, I'm struck by the words of Hubert Humphrey. He says, the moral test of government is how it treats those that are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the aged, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. I believe that there's a reason that Vice President Humphrey mentions those in the dawn of life, the children, first. It is because our future depends on the children. I know that that you, in these hearings and in your deliberations, are truly dealing with the future of the children of the state of Oregon. Several of the things that I wanted to talk about when I was the superintendent of the Bethel School District, our story is a pretty good story in terms of where we are in relation to others. As I heard the stories today, I was again saddened and shocked about some of the things that have happened across the state. It's not really happened in Bethel. I think Senator Devlin said there was 198 stories to tell. They're all different in many ways. In Bethel, we did something similar to what you talked about. In my 16 years there, when I came, our ending fund balance was about $500,000, and we built it to $3.8 million, and we just spent $2 million of that to get through the last year. We did not reduce days. We have not done a lot of the things that have happened in other places in Bethel. One of the things that has happened as a result of that, though, is our folks recognize the good things that have happened in Bethel. When we sat down to bargain with our teachers this year, they contributed, like many of the other teachers have across the state. They froze their salaries for the next 2 years. They took steps halfway through the year. They share in the insurance increase costs. So if the insurance costs are 10%, we share it 5 each. That was our agreement coming out. There is no reopener in our agreement. I know that was a concern by some folks here was, what about the reopeners? I think that we heard tonight that there may be 10 reopeners out there. You know, it could be that if a district lost 10 or 15 days and it's frozen, that there's a rationale for a reopener in some of those districts where people have already taken huge, huge decreases. But I can tell you that if you allocate $5.3 billion, that money is going to go to help kids across the state. It's not going to go to other kinds of reasons because those contracts are very much in place throughout the state. One of the things that the Bethel did is we built our budget on 4.8. And if you were to go out there right now and survey districts, probably most of the districts have built their budget on 4.8. That's the most common number that's out there. The question is what can you add if it's 5.05 or 5 or something like that? What I would tell you is that the one thing that has not been discussed is that when it was 4.8, there was a distribution between the 2 years that was front-loaded on the front, on the first year of the biennium. And that when we looked at it at Bethel, we recognized that if we were going to keep the program that we budgeted at 4.8 in 04-05, the second year of the biennium, that we would need $5 billion to do that. So in our district, the district I used to be in, Bethel, there would be no difference between 4.8 and 5. If it was 4.8, we would have to cut the second year. If it's 5, we'll be able to operate the second year with the things that we have just passed. I think that's a very common thing across the state, that when people see that, that that's the reality. If 5.3 is there, it would restore all of the cuts that Bethel took, about $1.7 million. We reduced that about in half with the PERS savings. We had initially budgeted PERS at 16, and when it dropped to 11, we'd reduce that about in half. So we would replace the things that we lost. Keep in mind that Bethel's in the city of Eugene, and the city of Eugene also has a levy that supports schools, and Bethel gets $1 million of that. So that would be essentially like another $200 million. So we're, you know, if you were to look at it, I always look at it like if there's $200 million, Bethel would get $1 million of that each year of the biennium.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Question center, where?
How much service does Bethel get from the Educational Service District, or do you?
We do. We're our Educational Service District is one that... that is one of the lower-funded education service districts. So they help us substantially in the area of special ed students and other programs, technology, and some of those kinds of things. I wanted to close with a story that I believe that our discussion here is not only an educational discussion, it's an economic discussion. And it hits home to me because I have a son. My son is 31 years old, and he has children that are 3 and 5. And if you're 31 years old and you have children that are 3 and 5, the most important thing to you is what is the education of these children going to be like. My son works and makes a lot of money. In fact, he makes a lot more money than I do, and good for him. I'm very proud of him, but it's not about money. He also represents a four-state area, so he can live in any of four states. He can live in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, or Alaska. He's chosen to live in Oregon. He's considering moving from Oregon because of the education. When he leaves, the money that he pays in income tax goes with him. I believe that when Multnomah County passed their levy, they stopped some flight that was being considered from Multnomah County to various other places because of the education program and concerns about education in this state. I believe it's an economic discussion because if we don't fund education adequately, we're going to have corporations that don't want to come here, and we're going to have people like my son who say, maybe it's better in Washington, maybe it's better in Idaho. I appreciate, again, the opportunity to speak to you. I appreciate the work that you do, and Godspeed in the things that you do. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Question?
Can I use a small question?
Sure.
Am I supposed to assume that because some districts have already budgeted around 4.8, 4.9, that adjustment is all that was necessary for you, and that if you get more, it's just a little gravy for you? Is that the message?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, what I was trying to explain is that since we're budgeted at 4.8 and that will fund us for the 03-04 year, what we were concerned about was the 04-05 year. And with the roll-up costs that we have, which are fairly minimal with our contracts that we have with our employees, keep in mind that the way they allocated money with that was to front-load the first year of the biennium. And so it is my belief that school districts that have budgeted 4.8, if that's what's allocated, they will have to cut in 04-05. They will not be able to maintain what they had in 02-03, in 03-04 and 04-05. That $5 billion would be what is really needed. So if it increases to $5 billion, I believe that those districts will not be adding new services. And if they do, that they won't be able to maintain them.
Right. That's better stated. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, another question. We really have a bunch of people, so we want to make sure we give them every chance to talk.
The question I wanted to ask was, since you're going to be replacing Ozzy, you're going to be in this building for a very long time, a little bit longer in this session, but probably future sessions. And I think there's another education process out there. Just looking at the mail I've been getting the last couple of weeks and emails, and I can think of one today that we got. I just wanted to put it on the record because I got one of the postcards from a group that I support, the Coalition for School Funding Now. And on the back of the postcard it said, fund schools adequately, fund public safety, fund the elderly, but don't raise my taxes. And I don't think, that to some extent, if you can comment about this as a person who's going to have to appear in this building, that the public understands that right now we're really not talking about just normal circumstances. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you are in this building. It doesn't matter if you're in the House or the Senate. Most of the people in this building admit that we need to raise revenue. They may disagree on the amount, but they admit that. And how can we get the – I'm not going to ask a question that broadly. But I think that's the problem that we're having in this building. In some ways, the building reflects the indecision of the building reflects the indecision of Oregonians, in a way.
I guess I would ask you to give a two-minute response to that. Then I'm sure you could have an in-depth discussion with our psychiatrists about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, if I knew the answer to that question, we probably wouldn't be here. But the reality is I think the Oregonians do want services for their people. I go back to Hubert Humphrey's comment, and those are three, the tests. The moral test of government is to take care of the children, those who are sick and needy, and the aged. Do that. In addition, I know you've got public safety and higher ed and all these other things that are coming at you in different ways. And I don't envy your jobs, the decisions that you need to make. And I understand that there's just as good an argument in many of the other cases for funding. I support all those other things. And in education, we feel the impact of when human services programs are not funded. We feel them in education. So my thinking about that is you have to find the right balance that works. And that you cannot forget the children in that balance. It's one of the most important pieces.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your guys' testimony. Can we get James Matisse, Rebecca Maitland, and Lorna Walker to come forward if they're still here? Okay. And if not, then we'll have Dawn Bonder, Nancy Wynn. Whoops. I'm sorry. I'm too darn fast. Let's have Dawn Bonder and Nancy Winston come up also, please. If you'd like to start, please go right ahead.
Thank you. I am Lorna Walker. I thank you for taking the time to hear the interests and concerns of people. As we look at this particular circumstance, everyone is addressed. The fact that there appears to be a need to address revenue, but that's really not fully the issue here in this particular circumstance. That cannot be left ignored. But what must be addressed here is the considerations of funding education. And as we look at this, the things that have come to mind as I have listened to the testimony of others and I read the various documents, whether we look at a 4.8, a 4.9, a 5.3, a 5.58, a $6.9 billion budget, what we're really looking at is a very delicate balance of what we're buying. We're buying something. And as I listen, sometimes I'm not totally certain that we are really weighing carefully what it is that we are buying and the impact that is made in that decision. And I don't say this as a criticism because it's merely an observation of what's happening, not by intent. The quality education model was designed very carefully, reflecting a tremendous amount of research by a large number of people. And it was established with on a very modest basis, making very modest incremental increases for the upcoming years. And what we're buying is a delicate balancing act of personnel, time, space, and resources. If you are in a classroom, and let's say hypothetically you have a 30-minute class. Some classes are 30, some are 40, some are 60. But say you have a 30-minute class. And let's say hypothetically that for some reason that there is a particular group of students that misses 5 minutes of that class period. Or maybe the entire group misses 5 minutes of that class period because of some important something that's happening somewhere. You can, in a very short period of time, document a stack of reflected learning that that group did not get to engage in. And that may be different activities. That may be different concepts. It may be very crucial basic skills that didn't have quite the full strengths of their address. So when we think about cutting a whole class period or then whole days, we are really making very, very significant decisions about the end result of what those students are going to walk out the door with. We're establishing an environment, an educational environment. It means a clean, safe place to be. It means that we have the resources and tools with which to work. It means that people have adequate time to get their heads together, to be prepared, and work together as individuals and teams to set about that best possible educational environment that permits learning, short-term and long-term. And when we hypothetically start dropping things here and there, we can very quickly set everything askew. And so when people are making these decisions, they make a 4.9, a budget based on a $4.9 billion, they're buying certain things. And they're also giving up certain things in that process. And so these decisions that are being made are very significant decisions. Timeliness of the decisions being made is important in terms of being cost-effective, efficiency. I believe someone commented how many $100,000 it costs to borrow internally for a specific item. Well, in like manner, if you have personnel that are spending their mental energies waiting to know, am I going to be here tomorrow? Am I going to have the resources that I need tomorrow? Should I be planning for umpteen weeks from now? Are we even going to be here then? It changes the focus and the force of energy that goes forth. And so there is a cost expenditure in terms of mental and physical energy that taxes people as well as financial cost when this is weighed back and forth. I'm not saying that we don't have to discuss things, but it's important to realize that we're spending something in this process.
Are you going to be able to,
pardon?
To kind of wrap up pretty soon?
That is exactly what I intend to do. My focus behind all of this is the key issue being that we have an opportunity, as was established by the design of the quality education model, to establish a fairly sound system. It's very easy, inadvertently, to legislate mediocrity. And it was clearly defined by everyone that that was not what they wanted and not what they were seeking. We have to be very careful that we don't inadvertently legislate mediocrity. And I thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate everyone's energy.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dawn Bonder, and I am here this evening speaking as a representative of the Coalition for School Funding Now. Thank you very much for the opportunity to voice my concerns and my opinions. During a recent visit to my parents' home in Las Vegas, the severity of our state problems were made painfully clear to me. Over coffee, I looked down at the headline of the June 23, 2003 Las Vegas Sun to a headline and cover story that really hit home. Oregon offers Nevada valuable lessons on taxes. In deference to the others who are waiting to speak, I won't read the article in its entirety, but I do want to read one telling sentence, and I quote, "Oregon is the shining example of what Governor Gwynn does not want Nevada to become." While accepting that many states are reeling from the current recession and that Oregon is not alone in its struggle to maintain state services, reading that Oregon is the poster child for how not to deal with these problems is very disconcerting. Our problems here at home have made the national news, being the state with the shortest school year, highest unemployment rate, and highest hunger rate does not make Oregon the place to be. Now, more than ever before, Oregon needs to make a statement. You, our legislators, need to draw the line in the sand and say, enough. Our schools need an adequate, stable, and reliable budget, and HB 5077A is none of these things. Funding schools in a responsible way will say volumes to all those across the nation waiting to see what Oregon will do next. How can we expect our economy to recover, let alone grow, when our public education system is a national joke? And while public perception is important to our economy, we also have a responsibility to the children of Oregon. Shortening the school year, increasing class size, and cutting programs will not help our students excel. By shorting our education budget, we handicap our students in countless ways. There is myriad research and information on best practices in the field of education. Instead of implementing these practices, we are forced to retreat our education system to something that is starting to resemble the schools of our past, not the schools of the future. Our schools need more. Yes, they need more money, but they also need more of a commitment from our leaders. We need you to assure that the amount of funding dedicated to our schools over the next biennium provides a full academic year to all school districts across our state. It needs to provide for reasonable class sizes and at least traditional extracurricular programs for students. The dollars dedicated to education need to be real dollars, in cash. HB 5077A is not predicated on stable dollars. School boards need to have a commitment from the legislature that the dollars allocated to each district will be forthcoming. We cannot expect school districts to make budgetary and hiring decisions based upon a moving target. And this past year is weighing heavy on the minds of many school board members. The multiple decreases in school funding throughout the year has eroded trust for this budget process among school districts and school boards. If we expect to see some of the deep and painful cuts that have been made over the last years begin to be repaired, the legislature must make adequate, secure dollars its top priority. HB 5077A is not a responsible K-12 budget, but a travesty. It doesn't matter if we're talking about Portland, Beaverton, Hillsboro, Coos Bay, or John Day. Students in each of these districts, as well as every other district in the state, deserve a budget that ensures a full year, reasonable class sizes, and program offerings that will prepare all students for success in their futures. Senator Schrader, committee members, I really appreciate the opportunity to sit here tonight and tell you how important a responsible education budget is to me. As a parent, a business owner, school activist, and Oregonian, I really want to reiterate that you can and you must do better than HB 5077A. Thank you for your time, and I have left written copies along with the full version of the article that I quoted for you.
Thank you. I just have a quick question because I did review the article that she included rather quickly. One, did Nevada pass their
not yet.
but two, I also noted that Nevada's contribution to their school system is about 30%. Where is the rest of the revenue? 30% of their budget is schools here compared to ours?
More local funding. They're set up on a more local funding. My parents have only lived there a year, so.
They're like our pre-measure five.
Exactly.
So. Well, thank you for the information.
Ms. Winston.
Chairman Schrader, Senators, I'm Nancy Winston. I'm a parent, adoptive and foster, as well as biological. I'm an Oregonian by choice, and I was brought here by the high-tech industry to manage some of their businesses. Last night, I was putting two of my sons to bed, Jeremy, who's 9, and Jacob, who's 5, and they asked about their day for today. And specifically, they were bugging me to have friends over this afternoon and evening, maybe go to the swimming pool. And I explained that I was going to be in Salem for school funding. And the answer I got was, oh, you're always working on school money. And, oh, no, not again. And my answer was, yes, again, and until. Parents like me are not going to go away. Until every Oregon child has a full school year, we must and will continue to work on this. What will differences in funding of districts across the state mean to students as districts cobble together local solutions to make up for the lack of a statewide solution? As a business manager, should I look at students from Albany different than those from Corvallis? Compare Coos Bay graduates to Lake Oswego graduates, or perhaps North Bend and John Day to Ashland? We need to ensure that all students in Oregon have access to quality education and opportunities past graduation. We can do better than the House education budget. Their plan is built on shifting sands. One high tide could erode the $250 million based on a hoped-for economic recovery. The budget must be adequate for all of Oregon's students, and it must be based on real revenue that any school board member or perhaps some of our math students in the schools can see makes a stable budget. Without a solid revenue foundation, no school board in the state will trust the money to appear out of thin air. Where can we get the revenue? I think probably many of you have some great ideas. I've heard some of them. They include business activity taxes, excise, or also known as sin taxes, reducing a lot of the loopholes in the tax code, limiting mortgage deductions, and eliminating pleasure boat exclusions. Any and all ideas should be on the table. Faced with a choice between closing a school, resulting in students having long commutes, or saying no to a lobbyist for a specific tax break, who will you choose to disappoint? When I think about why I must be persistent on school funding, I keep coming back to the fact that we didn't close schools during the Depression. I'm ashamed to be a citizen and taxpayer in a state that sees school closures as a viable solution to budget problems. So I'm asking you to be courageous and solve this so that Oregonians can hold our heads high. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
May I say one additional brief thing?
Certainly.
Just that I have appreciated the concern and the devotion toward maintaining our good credit standing as a state. I think that is so crucial that that be soundly maintained. And I know that the efforts that everyone is putting forth to accomplish that will reap great long-term rewards.
We certainly hope so. We don't want to go the California route if we can avoid it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can we get Pam McLean, Kevin Noreen, and Don Zerong? And I apologize if I mispronounced those names. Trying to give everyone at least 5 minutes so that everyone gets a chance to say at least their piece. Thank you all for waiting. Appreciate everybody.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Pam McLean, and I'm a parent from the Beaverton School District. And I feel like I'm going to kind of reiterate a lot of that's been said tonight, but I do promise you I will be very brief. I'm here tonight because I have to say that I was hugely disappointed in House Bill 5077A as a funding solution for our schools. House Bill 5077A does not even begin to provide a minimum basic education for our students. And if passed, the bill would be a direct order from Salem for school districts to lay off more teachers, shorten school years yet again, and cut more programs. And this is unacceptable. And after sitting here tonight, I believe that each of you on this committee understand that it's unacceptable. So I'm urging you as a committee and the leaders in Salem to do better. I'm urging you to provide a responsible and reliable K-12 budget. A K-12 budget comprised of real revenue dollars. School districts cannot and should not have to plan their budgets on a wing and a prayer. School districts must be guaranteed adequate and stable dollars. And with about a month to go before our schools open their doors, school administrators, teachers, parents, and students are looking to Salem and to you for leadership and solutions. And I'm urging you to take action, to provide leadership, and most importantly, to do what's right for our students. I think the best case scenario for our schools is a firm budget number. And I'm not an expert, but I think 5.3 is too low. I think that's a starting point to build on. But that budget number needs to be funded with real revenue dollars. We cannot expect school districts to confidently hire staff, restore programs with dollars they're not going to be able to count on getting. It's a scary time for school districts. And personally, one day I hope that I can say with pride, my kids attend Oregon Public Schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, Chairman Schrader and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Noreen, and I'm a newly elected school board member in Sherwood. I've been on the job for 29 days. I have a four-and-a-half-year-old and a seven-year-old. There'll be a second grader next year at the elementary school in Sherwood. I'm here tonight for a couple reasons. One, because I told my constituents that when I got elected that I would come and talk to you folks, and so 29 days into it, I keep my promise. The other reason why I'm here is because my wife told me I should come here because I told my constituents. That's right. And the third reason why I'm here is because I had a parent, a constituent, a mom, call me from Girl Scout camp today at 12:30 on her cell phone out in 95-degree heat and said, Kevin, I'm counting on you to go represent Sherwood tonight. Yeah. So that's why I'm here. My parents were both public educators. I'm originally from Seattle, so I'm originally a Washingtonian. And I have to be honest with you, when I was going to college here and Measure 5 passed, I swore to myself that I would never come back to Oregon and raise my kids here because I was concerned about public education. But I'm here, I'm getting involved, and I'm coming to talk to you, and I do live in Oregon, and I do care about public education, and that's why I'm here. I'm not a legislative expert, and I've reviewed the bill that we keep talking about that got passed, so I don't know a lot about that, but I do know a couple of things. First of all, the House bill that was passed, 5.05, and what I read is not actual cash. It's not something that I can count on as a school board director for my budget for our school district, and that concerns me. The second thing is that it appears from that figure that there is less money budgeted in the second year of the biennium, which, again, as a newly 29-day-old school board member, concerns me also. And third is that 5.05 does not put Sherwood back to where we were in the last year of operation. So I also advocate for 5.3 or above. Our superintendent, I think, gave you a figure of 5.58. So we are certainly, I am here today personally just to advocate for the higher figure. Just to give you a few items of what we're facing cuts this year, 22.75 total FTEs that we're going to be cutting. That will be 13 teachers. We're one of the largest growing districts in the state. If you haven't heard that already, I'll say it again so that you've heard it. We're the largest school district growing in the state. And so cutting 13 teachers and adding 112 students makes it very, very difficult for us. The growth is definitely a factor for us. I don't know about you, but when I went to school, I had PE, I had music, and I had art all my years. This year, we're looking to cut physical education for the elementary level. Last year, we cut music at my daughter's elementary school level. I'm a musician. I play bassoon. I think music and the arts is important, and I just can't understand it, why we're looking at not having these things K through 12. So that's bothersome. I also didn't have to pay to participate in sports when I was in school. I was in drama, I was in the band, I was in debate, and I didn't have to pay anything. I was on a tennis team. Today, if we go forward with what the budget is now, we will potentially be asking a student to pay $350 per sport. That is outrageous, and that is definitely going to impact, as earlier members of the committee have said. I mean, that is going to impact all levels of kids, lower income, higher income, it doesn't matter. That's $1,200 to play sports in high school is crazy. We're also cutting librarians, media specialists, so I don't want you to think that sports is the only thing, but we are hearing that from our community. I can't tell you what we would do with $5.3 billion because we've never really had that discussion. We are still reeling from last year having to cut days. We cut 7 days, and in effect what we did was balance the state's budget on the backs of our teachers, and I think that's an unfair burden for those people to shoulder. I think at this point right now we are going to have to start creating our own rainy day fund. So when you ask whether all the money is going to go into the classrooms, and as the gentleman, the superintendent from Lebanon, said that they spent their reserves, I can't sit here. I don't get to make the decisions. We make it as a board about where this money is going to go. But if we get 5.3, unless you folks present us with a rainy day fund, you may force us to use some of that money for the shock absorber that he mentioned earlier, that his shock absorber is gone. I will tell you, though, that with 5.3 or anything above that, that our kids in Sherwood will get a better education than we offered them last year. And so at that point, I think it's your responsibility to look to make sure that we do get the funding so that we can offer a better education for our kids in Sherwood than we did last year and in the past. Just finally, I like analogies, and I've been trying to think of an analogy of what is this funding problem that we're dealing with. And to me, maybe it's like this. Let's say that I've been offered a job at Ford or Intel or wherever. So I've been offered a job. I'm going to have a job in September. But I don't know whether I'm going to be a line worker, whether I'm going to be upper management. So that's my range. I have to feed my family, though. I have to buy them food. I'm not going to stop buying food for my family. But we know that eating just bread and water or rice or, you know, just milk and just a few basic amenities or even just eating fast food 7 days a week is not the best health program to put my family on. And, of course, if you could buy organics or you know, full balanced meals and covering all the food groups, that's where you'd want to be. And I think that's where we're at right now. That's just an analogy that I can come up with. Is I'm going to buy food for my family, but I don't know whether I get to buy them just bread and water and milk or whether I get to fill out the four basic food groups and three meals a day. And I think that's what we need to do for my family and for everyone's family here. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Chairman Schrader and members of the committee, I have a very brief prepared statement. My name is Don Zierung, and I've spent my entire professional life, 29 years, teaching in Oregon's public schools. My career has been one of great satisfaction. In my community of Beaverton, I have always felt a deep sense of appreciation for what I and my 2,000 colleagues do each and every day. Provide a high-quality, developmentally appropriate education for each of the students in our charge. The latest example of Beaverton's appreciation for the critical requirement of state and local government we call schools was the passage in May of our local option levy. The voters of Beaverton not only overcame the ludicrous necessity of the double majority, but in these painful economic times, they chose to raise their property taxes in order to provide the funds necessary to maintain a full school year. As you are all aware, Beaverton is the exception, not the rule. The debate you are currently engaged in over the K-12 budget comes down to this. Are you willing to accept program cuts and the reduction of the school year, or will this legislature look to the example set by the voters in Beaverton, declaring that the risks of inadequate school funding are too great and cannot be ignored? If you decide to support a K-12 budget similar to that passed by the House and proposed by the governor back in January, then at least please be candid with Oregonians. You should support the remarks of the governor several months ago when he acknowledged there will be no academic achievement gains in Oregon students with a $5 billion school budget. There will be more districts like Hillsborough closing the doors to 3 or 4 weeks early. There will be more advertisements such as the one I saw in Sunday's Oregonian promoting the new Vancouver housing development that has great schools that are open the entire year. I am hopeful you will do the courageous and arrest the decline in school funding, and I urge your support of the $5.3 billion K-12 budget for the next biennium. Thank you.
Thank you all. Very good testimony. Appreciate it.
Yes. I need to know, are they really open 12 months out of the year, or is it the school 9 months year in Vancouver?
I think what they were promoting was that their schools don't close 2, 3, or 4 weeks early because of budget short. Correct.
Thank you very much. Can we get Ann Smith, Jane Ansel, and Helen Bichon to come forward, please?
Thank you. I'm Ann Smythe. I'm a parent, and my husband is an educator. And this is my 6th trip to Salem since January, and thank you all for being here so late and so long. Hundreds of educators, students, and parents have been telling
legislators that we need a stable and adequate source of funding to educate Oregon's children. The House has not heard us. The Senate must listen. We did not elect you so that Oregon could become a national joke for its failure to fund schools. We elected you on promises to fix the unstable and inadequate system of funding public schools that has eroded the quality of education in Oregon since Measure 5 passed. The House has given us a budget that further threatens our schools' ability to deliver a decent education. We know from all the teacher layoffs, early closures, and cut programs around the state that Oregon schools are not just crying wolf. Oregon schools cannot plan their budgets on money that isn't real. A budget based on supposed savings and borrowed money cannot put schools on solid footing in the next biennium. While still inadequate based on the QEM, 5.3 in real dollars should be the absolute bottom line to fund our schools. In tough economic times, we face choices. We either choose to let our children, public schools, and educators, and indeed Oregon's very future, crumble in a bad economy, or we choose to protect and defend education by raising adequate funds because we know the value of thriving schools and well-educated citizens. Please make the right choice for Oregon's future. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Alan Bushong. I'm Mr. Chair and Senators. Alan Bushong, and I live at 4655 Lone Oak Road Southeast. I had one of the shortest drives, so I'll try to give one of the shortest presentations. I'm right in the middle of Senator Winter's district, and before that I was in the middle of Senate or Representative Winter's district. I'm the president of the Salem Kaiser Friends of Music, and I speak in that capacity. We're a nonprofit organization that represents the booster groups across the city that represent 8,000 families that have kids in music education. But we also speak on behalf of all public schools and of the class, and the, in favor of the strength of the classroom. I would like you to do what we do in our group. We're nonpartisan. We have more Republicans and Democrats and a lot of independents. Does that sound like your district, Senator Winters?
It's like my district.
And we'd like you to take that nonpartisan stand, too, because we just stand for the importance of all children having a good education, preparing them for their future. And we want the Senate leadership to stand up and say, and to take leadership and say, we're not going to play politics with our schools because our youth are too important. I'm here, though, primarily to people have spoken passionately about the value of schools. I certainly believe in the same, but I want to pop a myth. I just want to destroy a myth that's circulated that Salem Kaiser schools can get by on $4.8 billion of funding. And I'm going to distribute a letter here at the end of my testimony, or after we get up, the three of us. And Senator Winters, you got that in my email today. $4.8 billion doesn't work for Salem Kaiser schools. It works only if a huge amount of the money that should be for ESL or ELL, depending on the designation you want, money is diverted into other purposes, which is wrong, because the at-risk kids are the ones who most need the educational help. And they need that. You're providing that funding, and it should go to educate these kids and help keep them in schools. And our district, at the parents' urging, went out on a limb, and instead of increasing classroom size two across the board, chose to risk on the per settlement to keep classroom size the same. And we're way away from QEM. We're not even close to QEM. We'd love to be there. I'd love to see our elementary classes much smaller because that's what helps kids have a good start. But our school board went out on a limb, and we thank them for doing that. And your attorney general would say that that was a wrong decision. And if we lose on that, there's $7 million of loss. And finally, our schools are looking at fees, and they're looking at fees for classes, and that's illegal. I mean, that's how desperate people are getting. Our classes are too big. Our teacher morale is horrible. No one's talked about this, but this annual dance is driving teachers away, not just early retirement. It's driving great teachers away from the teaching profession. And we all know that the success of a student depends on a motivated teacher in the front of the classroom. So I'm here to ask you, 5.6 or 5.7 billion would be great, but please don't go beneath 5.3 billion. And you may want to know how to do this. And I would ask you to do this in order that we have, and once again, we need our at-risk kids, and we need classroom options because we need our youth to be engaged, energized, and enrolled. And if I can use a fourth E word, can we fix on what's essential? Can we fund essential services? And can I do not believe that as you're getting ready to head into double overtime, grew up in a basketball state, as I think you're getting ready to head into double overtime, I don't think you're going to do long-term reform. But can you look at the tax breaks, the deductions, and the credits that are given that are non-essential? And can you eliminate those in favor of essential services?
It's that important. Our daughter is now out of the public school. She graduated a couple years ago. But it's our neighbor's turn. They've got two kids in elementary schools. And I look at them, and we, my wife and I, our family supports public schools the same way we did almost 15 years ago when our daughter walked to school for her first grade of first day of kindergarten. So please use the words that have been used earlier. Take that courageous, nonpartisan stand. Don't make this an issue of party. Don't make an issue of politics. Make it an issue of kids and our future. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to thank my constituents for coming to testify. And just one thing, and the Salem-Keizer School District is not on record for 4.8. In fact, their conversation with me and the letter that we have from them is that was the figure that they used to build their base budget. The Salem-Keizer School District, and I have to really applaud them because you received from them this information today. And one of the things that Salem-Keizer School District has done in working with the community and others is that they're making their budget very transparent. The communities has asked to know specifically where the dollars are going, where they're making the reductions, and I need to say that because I think districts across the state need to take a clue from the Salem-Keizer School District. And I said earlier I commended the work between the superintendent and the union and others to try to make certain that no child that we were going to have classes, and they have made a lot of sacrifices in Salem-Keizer School District. And so, and the music issue, you have the best organized group of parents in the city when it comes to the decision of whether or not we're going to have music in our city or not. Those parents and the community are really there in full force. And those of us understand that there are many pathways to learning.
That's right.
And music is one of them.
Thank you.
Good evening, Senators. My name is Jane Ansell, and I'm affiliated with the Coalition for School Funding Now. I'm also the parent of a second grader and of an 18-month-old. I grew up in California and was in high school when Prop 13 was passed. Our parents thought they were getting a tax break. Instead, they saw our public school education disintegrate. Teachers were laid off, class sizes ballooned to over 40 children in most classes, and we had to pay to play sports. We had no art or music classes. We received no individual attention, and hope was at a minimum. This horror is now being mirrored in the Oregon public school system. A high school student from Hood River wrote these words in a May editorial in the Oregonian. The cuts to school funding have been devastating. Students are learning that their school can't afford to help them. At some point, kids just stop asking for help. He goes on to say, at this point, I don't think the majority of Oregonians are concerned that we are overfunding education. If you were still wondering why we fund public schools or why we have them, I recommend that you visit one. Public schools are the foundation of democracy. They give everybody the opportunity for a decent education. They give kids hope. Senators, if you believe, as do most citizens of Oregon, that four-day school weeks and tattered copies of textbooks and John Day are abhorrent, that teachers on food stamps define travesty, and that increasing class sizes, cutting school days, and cutting staff is wrong, then the rock-bottom minimum for the education budget should be $5.3 billion in real, live cash. If you believe in the children of Oregon, then I urge you to take a stand and approve a stable and reliable budget of no less than $5.3 billion. Please don't let your legacy be an underfunded school system. Oregon's children, every single one of them, deserve better. Oregon's future depends on good schools. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very, very much. Okay, I think we have three more that I've got on the record here. Linda Brown, Bill Swindells, and Claire Kader, please. Thank you for your patience. I thank my committee for their patience also. Mm-hmm.
Good evening, Chairman Schrader and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to allow us to speak before you tonight. My name is Linda Brown, and I'm the new chairperson of the Lake Oswego School Board, and joining me is Bill Swindells, who's a new member of our school board as well. In the Lake Oswego School District, we like to take some pride in our handling of the school funding crisis, because we have economized and downsized and stretched our resources at every level while successfully maintaining and achieving the highest standards of student achievement in Oregon. But we are now well past the point where further cuts to programs and services can be implemented without harming the basic and essential level of education that we provide. This past spring, the Lake Oswego School District eliminated 5 days from our school year. This decision was an abhorrent one for everyone involved, for school board members, for administrators, for teachers, for parents, for our business community, and of course for our students as well. I'm not sure if I can adequately convey the difficulty that we had in making this decision, or our very real sorrow and dismay as we cut our students' education short. This is a course of action that we have never had to pursue in the past. Not during the last recession, not during the implementation of Measure 5 limits, which you know hit us hard. It is a course of action we never want to face again. As a school board, we are responsible for the complete education of our students. And we know that in education, short-term liabilities translate to long-term losses for children. Lost teaching time is lost for a lifetime. Lost classroom time is never made up again. Untaught curriculum is never recovered. I had teachers approach me all spring to express their agony over deciding which lessons they would not have time to teach to this year's students. Every lesson is important, and every moment in the classroom is important. This is just one example among the many downsizing and restructuring decisions that have recently been made in our district. This past 2 years, our cuts total over $7 million in lost programs and services, a drastic and sobering amount for a school district of Lake Oswego's small size. I've provided a summary of these reductions attached to my testimony, but we are now graduating students who have never known a year without cuts to their education. They don't even know what they've lost. We need funding that is adequate. We need funding that is stable. Even in very rough economic times, a child cannot afford for even one of their 12 years in school to be shortchanged. By enforcing strict economy in recent years, the Lake Oswego School District was fortunate, and we managed to carry a significant balance of cash reserves accrued through years of prudent downsizing and very careful management, just like a business, is our patrons' demand. But the challenges of the past 2 years have completely obliterated those reserves. As a result, every dollar of state funding that we receive will have a direct impact on the level of program that we can provide. And you may not be aware, but Lake Oswego is the lowest funded district in Clackamas County. Although the district has already budgeted and made decisions for this next year based on a worst case scenario, every dollar of funding that you can provide above that worst case scenario will be spent in this coming year. We are desperate to replace so many of the resources that we've lost, from librarians to support staff that we know our students need. Most importantly, the school board feels strongly that the final school allocation reached by this legislature must consist of stable and real dollars for both years of the biennium. In order to plan for the best use of scarce resources and in order to provide the greatest stability in programs for our students, we must be able to count on the state appropriation as being real dollars. And I would like to add that to my knowledge, not a single state with a sales tax has passed that tax by will of the voters. It's the legislators' job, and it's the legislators who universally have stepped up to the plate. Given the realities of the current state revenue picture, we recognize the difficulty of the task that you now have before you. And we can accept the assertion that it will not be possible for you to provide schools with all of the resources that we desperately need. But we cannot accept that the legislature is powerless to do anything to help districts. We need to survive this economic crisis together, but if the state cannot provide all of the resources that we need. Please give districts the authority to try to do whatever we can for ourselves. In the absence of a long-term solution to school funding issues, we must develop a variety of short-term solutions that will allow districts to work with whatever means they have locally available with their local constituencies. Different communities in the short term will seek out different strategies if you allow us that. Senate Bill 819 would allow districts to increase the amount of revenue that could be raised with a local option levy, but still stay within the caps of Measure 5 limitations. 4 years ago, the legislature approved making a local option available to school districts, and we did so. The reasons and circumstances that made it necessary then are even more dire and more pronounced today. Public education in the state of Oregon is facing an unprecedented crisis due to a lack of sufficient funding, and our students and our children are paying the price for it. Raising the cap on a local option authority is only a stopgap measure. It will not provide stable statewide funding for our schools, nor will it even solve all of Lake Oswego's problems. It will, however, allow local taxpayers to provide some immediate assistance to the children growing up in our communities who can't afford to wait for the long-term solution, which is not yet even on our horizon, and whose education is still taking place this fall, right now. In the absence of adequate state funding, we ask you to please advocate for Senate Bill 819 before the end of this legislative session. And we believe that the budget approved by the House is unstable. It is thoroughly inadequate to ensure the quality of education in our district and in our state. And we hope that you will use every means at your disposal to generate a higher allocation in real dollars for our students. Thank you for the privilege of testifying this evening.
Thank you very much. Mr. Swindell.
Thank you, Chairman Schrader, members of the committee. I'm not going to reiterate all the great meritorious points that have been made about the value of education and the importance of it. I'm going to just make a brief comment as to remind us of the difficulties of process. Schools are at a great disadvantage as they go through the budget process. They represent nearly half the general fund. That makes them the largest single source of places to get dollars to balance the budget. They are your most poorly represented constituents. 30% of households have kids in K through 12. If you include businesses as taxpaying, a taxpaying household is 20% of households are as taxpayers. They are not in a position to retaliate as much as they can bring forward arguments. I hate to be cynical or scolding, but that is an impression. And I think schools absorb the greatest number of unfunded mandates. The number, I'm, again, new and becoming familiar, but I think it's 13% of our mandates are funded by the federal government. We look to the state for the balance of that. What I would hope is that this legislature does not sell Oregon's future as a way to, by shorting schools, as a way to get out of this session and get this behind you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank two of my school board members for coming here to testify on this very important matter. And even though I'm not speaking solely about the Lake Oswego School District, because there are literally dozens of school districts that were in this circumstance, when I became a House member, they were still actually one of the capped school districts as equity was being brought up to a level. So from the passage of Measure 5 and putting in the new formulas, they were capped all the way from that time. And I think the first year in terms of the school formula that we got outside the cap, or everybody came up to that level, was about 99. So they've had about 2 or 3 years of relatively flat, slowly rising, and now they're looking at potentially declining revenue. And while all these school districts have different stories, all 198 of them, and from different perspectives, being largely having the same funding for over a decade is a very difficult way to fund programs. I don't think there's any example in state government, in any of our agencies, that have been flat funded for a decade.
Very compelling testimony. Yes.
First, I'd like to thank you all for giving us the opportunity to come and express ourselves on this very important issue to all Oregonians. My name is Claire Carter. I'm here as a parent. I'm a mother with three children in Portland Public Schools. However, I'm not here to speak to you as an urban mother, but I'm here to speak, if I may be so presumptuous, for the other Oregon, and this is the rural Oregon. My family roots are east of the Cascades. Both my parents and my older brother are graduates of Eagle Valley High School, no longer exists because it was consolidated. I spent 2 years at Richland Elementary School. For those of you who aren't familiar with these places, they're all in rural Baker County, about 20 miles from the Idaho border. My grandmother's family were pioneers in the Grand Ronde Valley. I have aunts, uncles, shirttail relatives in almost every burg community, wide spot in the whole area of northeastern Oregon. In rural Oregon, I have to say, schools are the keystone of community. Special school events, Friday games, are the one thing that brings everybody in the community together. The economic reality of rural Oregon is that there are not many opportunities to make a simple living, let alone get ahead to the really good life. Schools and a good education offer the best passport to a bright future in rural Oregon. When the basic K through 12 schools are inadequately funded, the very fabric of our rural communities are threatened. When athletics, music, technology classes are cut, the future of some of our most resourceful citizens of our state is made less bright and opportunities are lost. Urban areas have educational options, as we've been hearing this evening. Rural areas have no options frequently. The local public schools are the best and frequently the only opportunity to get out of rural poverty. This legislature has the responsibility to provide an adequate education to all children in this state. The current K-12 budget proposal is totally inadequate. Rural schools, though, will feel the bite of this budget much more cruelly than urban or suburban areas because there are no options for these school districts and for these children. I urge you, in the interest of all the parents and the children in this state, to look for more revenue to fund schools at the $5.3 billion level for this biennium. It will keep hope alive for these parents in rural areas, hope that their children's education will be good enough to ensure a future for their children. Your responsibility as legislators and our responsibility as citizens is to make decisions that provide all the children of this state the best future we can give them. And the foundation of the future is the best education we can provide our children. That's all our children all over the state. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Mr. Carter for giving me the segue to make a statement that I intended to make when all the people had testified. But I just want to point out for the record and for the committee members that except for this latest testimony, we have heard from communities that have seen a downturn for the last 2 years or so. I represent a district that's been on the decline, a drastic decline, for the last 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. It's a very much different situation. My people don't have reserves. They're in a very difficult situation. You folks have talked about, and I guess I first want to say I very much appreciate all of you who have come forward and testified because it's an important part of the story. But there is another story out there that I want to express. We've lost, and I used to serve on the Coquille School Board before I came to Salem. We lost programs 15, 20 years ago that you folks are concerned about right now, and with very little help from the state. In my opinion, after sitting on the Education Committee this session, the distribution formula in this state is a failed process, a failed formula. And so, although I very much support what we're trying to do here and take care of the needs of your districts as well, this body needs to really face the real cruelty of what's going on in rural Oregon. I mean real rural Oregon, where we're outside the I-5 metro area, and we have the resources. We have the ability to make a living and a good living and contribute to the state, but we've been shut off from the ability to do that. and I serve on the Natural Resource Ways and Means Committee, the chair of that committee. I've spent this session trying to deal with the restrictions and the encumbrances of why many of these businesses in rural Oregon can't survive. So, thank you for the opportunity to make that statement.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate everyone's. Is there anyone out there that didn't get a chance to testify? I appreciate everyone coming, and I appreciate the committee for hanging in. I appreciate the passion of the committee. We've heard some pretty passionate statements by virtually everyone here about their commitment to education and the concerns about the state as a whole. So with that, we will adjourn. Thank you.
Sure.